You're listening to The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe, your escape to reality.
Hello and welcome to The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe. Today is Wednesday, July 12th, 2006. This is your host, Stephen Novella, president of the New England Skeptical Society. With me today are Bob Novella.
Hello.
Evan Bernstein.
Hello, everyone.
Perry DeAngelis.
Righto.
And Jay Novella.
Hey, gang.
What's up, guys?
Welcome, everyone. We had hoped to have Rebecca on the show this week, but she is still gallivanting about Europe and was too busy to join us. But I hope she's having a good time. She will be back with us next week.
She's drunk in an alleyway right now. Everybody
perhaps.
We'll get in which country?
It doesn't matter.
We'll get the full report next week. So as we speak, STS-121, the space shuttle, is carrying out its mission. Just thought I'd give that a mention. It's always nice to
about time
to have the space shuttle flying.
Yeah, right? How long was it, Bob?
A year, right?
Two launches in a year. Something like that. It was crazy.
You know, space program's not what it used to be, people.
That's for sure.
It's unfortunate. Sad.
We're in a lull, basically. We're at the tail end of the space shuttle legacy, and we haven't yet put up a replacement. So it's going to be a lean 5 or 10 years until we get the next generation online.
We got to put this whole clunker to bed and build a new one.
We do. So one more major disaster, and that will end the space shuttle program, of course.
Yep.
And it may end even before that if they continue to have technical problems.
Does anyone know, just as a side note, does anyone know why the heat shield on the space shuttle is a bunch of tiles and not one sheet?
At the time, with the material science that we had, that was the best they could do. The tiles need to be able to expand and contract, you know,
yeah.
and by having them all separate tiles that could move past each other, that was the solution. Although,
plus, Perry, it makes it very, not easy, but it makes it possible to replace pieces of the heat shield. They have a guy whose job is specifically to recreate those tiles. Their dimensions are... he uses a machine or whatever to recreate those tiles, and he hand carves them and all this stuff. It's very complicated, but they replace a ton of those tiles
every mission.
Every time. Yeah.
Wouldn't it just be easier to have one piece, click it on and off, have a new one ready, click it on?
The next generation will probably have a one solid surface, you know, not
it
tiles.
It should.
It's, you know, what is it, 30-year-old technology?
It's 25-year-old technology, 30-year-old, like
30,
you said.
30 at least. Put it to bed.
NASA has some really cool videos. They have, you know, they attach cameras to different parts of the shuttle, and you could look at forward and aft camera views by going. We'll have the link on our notes
page. That's great.
They really are
fun to look at.
If anybody out there hasn't seen it yet, I highly recommend taking a look at one. I love the one where they show it go all the way from the launch pad to orbit.
Mm-hmm.
And you literally, like, see it, like, you see Florida drop out into nowhere, right. You know what I mean?
My favorite video was the one that showed that little gremlin on the wing. That was awesome.
Right. So I think that's an example of fusing a memory from something else. That was the Twilight Zone movie, right?
Twilight Zone?
Bob, there's something on the wing.
Nice, Jay.
So a couple weeks ago, a very large asteroid zipped past the Earth.
Grazed our temple.
It did.
If it hit us, what would have happened? Direct hit, no glancing blow.
It would have done some very, very serious local damage. I mean, it wouldn't cause any extinctions, but it would wipe out, like, you know, a vast tract of land. The initial estimates I heard said that it would devastate a continent, but I think they revised that downward. The damage would have been pretty dramatic, though, but not that devastating.
I'm unimpressed by anything less than an extinction-level event. You know, I've seen too many movies. I'm jaded.
You know, it's unusual. Whenever we have these close calls, it's a little bit of concern there because it really brings home the fact that we could get hit. But it makes me really hope that, you know, this is the one that everyone's going to start taking it seriously and really start mapping this out and just searching full-time and put a lot of people on it. And how many times have we seen one not approaching us, but leaving, you know,
on the way out,
moving away from us?
Like, that's the wrong side to see it. You know, what we need is a full-blown plan on dealing with these things. I mean, we should be deflecting them before they get near us.
Well, what are we going to do? You know, let's say you see a 5-mile asteroid coming towards the Earth. What are you going to do about it?
Perry, we need time. If it's a few months away or a year away, we are toast. There's nothing we could do about it. Now, there's lots of options. One very interesting new option I read about was that if we could find this early enough, all we would really have to do is park a big ship and just use the gravitational pull of the ship to slowly change its orbit enough so that it misses us. And that's all it would take.
Wow, I never heard that one. That's cool, Bob.
And then there's other plans. You know, some people think, oh, let's just blow it out of the sky, so to speak. And that generally wouldn't be a good idea, because then it would cause, you know, more widespread damage, because you'd have lots of little pieces hitting us instead of one big one.
I like the one where you attach a rocket engine to it and just nudge it,
That's possible, too. I mean, I think those plans are being seriously considered. But the key is we got to know as soon as possible when it's, you know, 15 years out, 20 years out. So we've got the time.
Which means we have to survey all of the near-Earth asteroids. There are some astronomers who are arguing now, like this guy David Asher from Armagh Observatory in Northern Ireland, that our previous estimates of the average time between impacts is actually a lot, is too high, that they're going to be
less.
That they probably will occur at a higher frequency than our previous estimates, because there are more of these, you know, unknown near-Earth asteroids than we knew before. So the more we survey, the more we realize it's out there, the estimates only go up.
Well, anyway, they missed us again, so we're good. The aliens didn't win this time.
Another news item caught my eye this week. Scientists explore the effects of psychedelic mushrooms.
Cool, man.
Right. So this is, obviously, we've known about these for 40 years, but they haven't really been researched very much. Scientists have been investigating a specific chemical called psilocybin, which is a known hallucinogen. And what I think is interesting about this is that what they found is the participants in the study, even after a single dose of this, had a profound spiritual experience, and it affected them for weeks in some cases.
Wow.
So, Steve, the conclusion you would draw from that is that we're hardwired to have those.
That's right. Well, we have to be. And there have to be receptors in our brain that produce those experiences.
But we've known about that region of the brain for quite some time now. We didn't need to hallucinate.
That's right. This is just one more line of evidence that supports this. But it is actually probably a fruitful line of investigation that just hasn't really occurred.
So, Steve, what'd they do? They pulled in a number of people, probably college students. And you know, just they'd eat this, and they...
No, the volunteers had an average age of 46, they said, had never used hallucinogens and had participated to some degree in religious or spiritual activities like prayer, meditation, or discussion groups. They tried psilocybin during one visit to the lab. They also had, like, control subjects who got stimulants like Ritalin.
So these weren't hippies they tested it on, right?
I'm surprised they didn't give it to any hardcore atheists. I don't know what they would have thought.
Yeah, it's interesting. Two-thirds called their reaction to psilocybin one of the five top most meaningful experiences of their lives.
Wow.
There you go.
Well, it is all natural, so it must be good for you.
Steve, from a medical standpoint, how dangerous is it to do this?
Well, some of them did have dysphoric reactions, or they became very agitated, and you can cause harm to yourself in this state. So, of course, you know, the physicians in the news interview said, do not try this at home. It's not safe.
How about neurological damage or psychological
damage? Not clear.
Damage?
I mean, the interesting thing is that some of the effects were so long-lasting. You know, obviously, with any of these drugs, the neurological damage potential is with addiction and permanent changes that occur from that. But the study was looking at just the short-term effects.
I can't think of another illicit drug that gives you a trip for weeks.
But the implication is interesting that, you know, our brains are hardwired for the sensation of this sort of religious connection to the universe and this profound sense, you know, of spirituality. You can trigger it with a chemical. You know, that's very interesting.
Hell, with me, you could trigger it with a meatball.
Last news item, this is a little 9/11 follow-up. In the news in the last couple of weeks, there's been a talk of this professor, University of Wisconsin professor Kevin Barrett.
Oh, that jackass.
Who is teaching a course, and the course contains a week of discussing conspiracy theories surrounding 9/11. Basically, he believes that the United States attacked itself on 9/11 and that they're hiding a big conspiracy. The kind of stuff that we've talked about on this podcast, you know, over the last few episodes or so. Now, this has caused quite a stir. The debate is, what should be the response of the University of Wisconsin? Representatives from that state and others are criticizing the university, saying that they should fire him, censor him for promoting these ideas. The provost of the university says, you know, we respect his academic freedom. You know, we don't want political pressure to silence academics. And he assures us that basically students in his course will be free to espouse different views.
Also, you know, I saw this guy interviewed on Hannity and Combs, and I have to say I was extremely disappointed in the way Hannity approached this. It was really almost, I don't know, I would say reprehensible. It was terrible. This guy, Barrett, actually came across as being, you know, somewhat, you know, ostensibly reasonable and calm and collected. Hannity just seemed to throw ad hominems at him. I mean, I got some quotes here. He said, the evidence is overwhelming to you because you're a conspiracy nut. Oh, good one. Good one. You got him there. Or most people think you're a nut. You know, and meanwhile, this guy's saying, you know, it's like, wow, is that the best you can do? I mean, this guy threw out a couple facts to support his case. In 10 minutes, I got some good information on them on the internet, you know, from apparently, you know, some reliable sources. I mean, it seemed like Hannity did not prepare at all. And what really got me was that this guy Barrett threw out some, you know, skeptical buzzwords like he's interested in training people how to use critical thinking skills to look at the evidence in any area and come to their own conclusions. You know, it was surprising. You know, I was just thinking, wow, this guy thinks, you know, he's on the side of science and critical thinking.
Well, Hannity is not a skeptic by any measure. The guy's a political analyst and he's an advocate.
But that's just bad journalism. Forget about whether or not he's a skeptic. And you actually, I mean, he basically brought this guy on the show just to be a freak show, just so he could call him a nut job. Didn't really feel like he had to prepare. So he basically, for the sensationalistic aspect of it, and does a total disservice by essentially, you know, creating a venue in which the 9/11 conspiracy theorist is the reasonable one, you know, of the two that in the exchange. That's just horrible journalism.
That's the worst part of it.
Well, the thing is, guys, let's face it. The guy is a college professor. He probably didn't come off with an attitude, and, you know, he didn't come on with his guns blazing. The fact is, we disagree with what he is teaching his students and what he was saying on the show. But it doesn't mean that the guy needed to be smacked down hard because, you know, he was being arrogant or anything along those lines.
He was being a little arrogant. I mean, he said multiple times he studied the fact, you know, studied the record for 2.5 years, and he said, "I don't think I know that our government was involved." He said, "I know it."
Yeah, he's, you know, I asked a mutual friend of ours who's an English professor whether or not he agrees with this decision, and what he wrote back to me is as follows. It's short. I said, "You agree with this decision to let this guy teach at the university?" And he said, "No. There's a difference between critical inquiry and quackery. This guy's a loon, and his students won't have the gusto to effectively put his theories to the test. He should have had to pass through a gauntlet of his peers and would unquestionably not have been able to emerge with his craziness intact on the other side of that." I agree with that analysis.
Perry, you know a professor?
You bet.
I basically agree with that as well. I mean, I think that we have to be very careful in terms of respecting academic freedom, and we shouldn't let the politics of the day decide on intellectual discourse, you know, in universities, which are supposed to be a little bit sort of protected intellectual environments. However, there is a line beyond which, you know, there, you know, quality control comes into place. This guy is not just advocating this in his private time or as an aside. He's teaching this to students. And the university does have a right, I think, to step in and just say, for the quality control of what their students are being taught, say, this is not appropriate. This is quackery. This same exact issue came up with John Mack, you know, the Harvard psychiatrist who believed that, you know, some of his clients, his patients, had been abducted by aliens.
Well, you know, Steve, I think in this circumstances like this, the form for the teachers to do this would be much more in a optional lecture that they want to give on their own time after hours.
The vast majority of undergraduate students are not equipped to filter what this guy is going to tell them.
But what about the basic fact that this person is 100% wrong in his facts, in his evidence, of which he has probably none, and just it outright has no place in any level of academia as far as I'm concerned. He should be censored.
I agree, but only if it's demonstrable nonsense, which I think in this case it actually is. It is demonstrable nonsense.
Yeah, agreed.
It can't just be controversial or maybe a little odd. It has to be so far beyond the pale that you could take that kind of action. Otherwise, you know, we have the thought police in our universities, and I just disagree with that in principle.
You have to be careful.
I would actually prefer to protect the fact that no thought police would enter into universities and teaching. I would rather have a few idiots like this guy slip through than for them to add in a system that comes down hard on
exactly. On, but again, he's stepping over the line by teaching this in class, in my opinion.
Let me end this with one good quote that he had. He said, "You think it was 19 guys with box cutters led by a guy on dialysis in a cave in Afghanistan. That's the craziest conspiracy theory of all of them."
The argument from personal incredulity.
Yeah.
Boy, talk about melting it down.
Let's go on to a couple of emails.
Boob.
Here we go.
All right. So I got two different emails in response to my discussion on supplement regulation, which I think was the episode that I did by myself. And I don't want to go over this whole issue again, but there's just a couple of points that I want to bring out with this. Let me read some points from these two emails. This first one comes from John Woods, and John writes, referring to, you know, basically I took the position that free market forces would not control quality control supplements and drugs, that we do need testing and we do need standards. And he said, "The argument presented, cut to its essentials, is only us guys, the experts, can really understand what is going on here, and we should be allowed to control what you do, what you can have when you and when you can have it. This argument, which experts in all fields make all the time, while it contains clear elements of truth, is enormously self-serving and elitist and disappointingly often wrong. Much as you could supply for most other fields examples of how regulation is protectionist and leads to outcomes not in the best interest of its consumers, I can provide many examples of how regulation in medicine assures protection, the economic position of the status quo, rather than good outcomes for patients." He finishes, while it is one of the most difficult things to do, I strongly suggest that one apply the same degree of skepticism to your own expertise and that of your profession and colleagues that you do to the rest of the world." Another email comes in. This one's from Scott Wood, and he writes, after saying some nice things about our podcast and admitting that he is a libertarian in temperament, he also says, "And yes, I don't believe that the FDA should be allowed to ban anything." That's the Food and Drug Administration, just to clarify his position. He says, "The arguments that consumers can't drive the market for supplements because that market at the moment seems to ignore evidence that you and I consider important is a non sequitur. Supplement consumers may either be ignorant of or indifferent to that evidence." So basically what they're both saying is that the government doesn't have the right to tell people what they should do, and that we don't have the right to set up regulations that are based upon standards, even if we think that they are reasonable. And I don't want to get into basically a political discussion of regulation, and because this is not a political show. That's the only reason. Obviously, I have views about this, but the reason why I thought I would bring this issue back up is because I do want to make one point. I think where both of these emails go wrong, and they go wrong in a way that has actually been observed in the past about libertarians in general, is that they confuse their political views with logical and skeptical views, or they're at least portraying a political choice as if it was the only choice that is consistent with skepticism and logic. And that's where I depart from them. Again, I don't care about what the political choice is. It's the characterization of it as scientific or logical. Basically, what I was discussing was the very specific question, which was brought up by a previous email, of whether or not market forces can result in the outcomes that we want in drugs and supplements, namely quality control. And my point was that the market forces are such, and the history, I think, has shown this multiple times, and the free market forces have done nothing to quality control this industry, either before or after. In fact, all they have led to is more fantastical claims and more glitzy marketing. So that was my point. They're both making the point that the government doesn't have the right to regulate what people do. That's not a scientific or a skeptical argument. That is a political argument. It's a value judgment.
And apparently they just haven't read the Constitution lately about the limits that the government has and does place on us every single day.
Yeah, I mean, but that's again a political argument. That's an argument about what rights the government should have relative to the rights that the people have.
And they can hear the answer to that question on our other podcast, the Political Guide to the Universe.
Right. If we had a political show, then we could get into the other issue. One more email before we go on to our interview. This one comes from Mark Kelly from the UK, and he writes, "Dear guys and Rebecca, great show, the perfect mix of hard facts, debunking, and humor. Long may you podcast. I realize that the following topic may be outside the scope of the Skeptic's Guide, but I'm seriously worried that, and you guys may be able to give me a straight answer that I can trust. Should I believe this statement? Civilization as we know it is coming to an end soon. This is not the wacky proclamation of a doomsday cult, apocalypse, Bible prophecy sect, or conspiracy theory society. Rather, it is the scientific conclusion of the best, most widely respected geologists, physicists, and investment bankers in the world. These are rational, professional, conservative individuals who are absolutely terrified by a phenomenon known as global peak oil." And he gives a couple of references. What do you think? Should I move to New Zealand? Are you coming too? Well, Mark, I don't think you should move to New Zealand. I actually think you should move to Addis Ababa. That's by far a superior location.
I'm checking my map now.
Actually, I just like saying Addis Ababa. Yeah, this is, you know, a very... I think we talked about this briefly on one podcast before, the whole concept of peak oil. In a nutshell, the idea is that at some point, we're going to get past our peak oil production, that the amount of oil that we're dragging out of the ground is going to decrease, and yet worldwide need for oil is continually increasing, and that this is going to result in a significant change in our civilization, which runs on oil. So the short answer is that, well, yes, that's going to happen, but civilization, as we know, is always coming to an end because it's always significantly changing. It changed with the internet. And there will be a time when we are not running our economy on oil because we simply don't have the oil to do so. But I wouldn't panic, because what the doomsday predictions always fail to take into consideration, and this has been going on for a century, where you start with some current trend, you extrapolate it into the future, they always assume that it's a zero-sum game, that our resources are finite. But the false premise, I think, in there is that there's one resource which is not finite, which is not a zero-sum game, and that is human ingenuity.
Of course. Of course. The change that's coming does not have to be a change to oblivion.
Right. Our economy will change over to an ethanol, a hydrogen economy, an alternative fuel economy, whatever.
Yeah, but I also think, to give what he's saying just a little credit, there's definitely... there's always signs that come and go that say, okay, this is a bad situation. We're not dealing with it. The fuel thing is the biggest one in my book. Like, you know, okay, we talked about the meteorite problem earlier. Are we dealing with it? No. Are we really dealing with the fuel problem? No. As of today, we're not. And I really don't feel comfortable thinking that somebody in the future is going to figure out this one at the last minute. I think that an ounce of prevention is worth the effort.
Sure. I mean, there's always the degree to which we will be ahead of the curve versus behind the curve. But the thing is, as this becomes an issue, alternative fuels will become more cost effective. The return on investment and research will become more lucrative. And then the problem will be solved over time.
I have zero fear of oil riots in the streets. Zero.
I agree.
Okay. This will be solved.
I don't think anyone knows exactly what pathway it's going to take, but we're not headed for a disaster, because human ingenuity always, so far at least, has always found a way to work a way out of these resource problems. We have an interview this week with Neil Adams. Some of you may recognize the name. Neil Adams is a comic book artist, but we're going to be talking to him about his scientific ideas. Now, a few times on this show, we've interviewed people who can loosely be called true believers, you know, not scientists or skeptics, but people who are advocating the belief in Bigfoot or ESP or some belief like that. And this is definitely one of those interviews. The purpose of these kind of interviews is to hear people with a different point of view defend themselves in their own words, and to sort of analyze their approach and their thinking about such things. And I think it's going to be a very interesting interview, and we'll talk a little bit afterwards. So let's go to the interview now. Joining us now is Neil Adams. Neil, welcome to The Skeptic's Guide.
Thank you. I'm glad to be here.
By way of introduction, Neil is a rather famous, actually, comic book artist known for his illustrations of Batman and the X-Men, who later in life has decided to switch gears a little bit in his career and has been working on some what he considers to be revolutionary ideas.
Actually, I don't know if I switched gears. I've actually been doing this for about 40 years.
Is that right?
Yeah.
And you're also still doing involved in illustration and
I do illustration. I do advertising. I do commercials, those Nasonex B commercials that you see on the air with the Nasonex B flying around.
Did you do the voice, Neil?
That was, I can't say who that voice was, but it's obviously the person who you think it is.
Right.
Who did Zorro recently, but I'm not saying that.
I got it.
Lots of people do Zorro in their homes.
Neil, that B is a computer generated, though. Did you design the image?
I designed it, and my studio animated it.
Oh, cool.
Well, let's get to your scientific idea. So can you encapsulate for us in a nutshell what it is that you're claiming?
I think probably not, but I will attempt it. 40 years ago, the scientific community and the geological community more or less came to the conclusion that all the continents were once together in one big giant continent on one side of the Earth. And presumably, being somebody who deduces at least in a minor way, I assume that the rest of the Earth, three quarters of it, was ocean 5 miles deep, 4 or 5 miles deep, or 2.8 miles deep according to how you calculate it. It seemed to me that if I were jinking along in my comic book spaceship and I looked at this planet, I would say that this was a very, very strange planet. One big giant island on one side and the rest of it ocean all the way around. Seemed very odd to me, although I agreed, at least just as with anybody that I ever knew, agreed that it sure looked like Africa and South America fit together. Mm-hmm. So they took that thought and they said, well, you know, it's not only Africa and South America, but North America and Europe, and you can see how they go together, so why don't we check this out? And so they did. They checked the Atlantic Ocean out, and they realized that tectonically these continents fit together. My goodness. And then they went back in history and they looked at dinosaurs and different animals, and they discovered that there were certain animals that lived on all seven continents, like an Allosaurus. So they said, well, based on this, we have come to the conclusion that all the continents were all together on one big giant island. Seems a little strange to me. And it seemed to me that nobody had really done a lot of checking in the Pacific Ocean, just the Atlantic Ocean. But, of course, we're Americans and Europeans, and we know exactly how everything is. So I can understand that. Then this Australian professor of geology, the guy's name was Samuel Carey, came and announced that he felt that, no, in fact, the Earth was smaller and that all the continents were, in fact, linked together and that the continents formed one big giant island on the whole of the Earth. And I thought, well, gee, you know, I've liked science since I was about 13 years old, and I like the common sense of science when it makes sense to me. This one made a lot more sense than this idea of a giant island on one side of the Earth. I could visualize it, but I could more easily visualize this outer skin covering the whole of the Earth and then the Earth growing and the outer skin cracking apart and basically staying in the same place it is, not swimming around like bumper cars all over the surface of the Earth, but essentially moving outward as the Earth grew. And it sort of fit into everything else that I knew at that time. Many dinosaurs were four times as big as the dinosaurs than the animals that exist on the Earth today. There were many other things that struck me very oddly. One of them was nobody seemed to take any tectonic sampling in the Pacific, just in the Atlantic, to prove the point. But nobody seemed to care much about the Pacific. Why were they doing this? Well, what happened was that Sam Carey presented his case, and there was a battle. I mean, it was a very serious battle. It's not just me, you know, showing up here 40 years later saying, oh, I think that the Earth grew. There was a big battle in the scientific community over this, and Sam Carey lost. Mm-hmm. Why did he lose? Well, the first reason he lost was that they found subduction. Subduction was, they said, that certain continents at a certain point in the ocean dove under other continents and subducted under those other continents and then went back into the magma. At that time, that they assumed that magma was the second layer underneath the Earth and that there was this big, vast amount of magma down there. Of course, that has proved to be untrue.
Although, just to be precise, you know, just for our listening audience, subduction is the ocean plates actually subduct underneath continental plates. Continents don't go underneath other continents.
Yeah, that's what you're saying now, and I agree with you that geology has moved forward in the past 40 years, and now they say it's the oceanic plates that subduct under one another. Actually, they say that the oceanic plates more or less subduct under continental areas.
Right.
Okay. Then they didn't say that. Now, one of the reasons they didn't say it then was because they had to account for the fact that presumably at some early time on the Earth, the whole Earth was covered with granitic rock and then basalts underneath that, and three-quarters of that, for some reason, seems to be missing.
Now, what do you mean missing?
Well, if you assume that the Earth, at some point, science tells us, remember when you were in school, they said, well, all this stuff was floating around in space, and then gravity came along, and it gathered it all together into these planets and this sun and these moons, and it was molten, they tell us.
Mm-hmm.
Remember that?
Yeah.
It was molten, and it accreted. Accreted means that the heavier stuff went to the center, and the lighter stuff went to the top. Now, it accreted, and presumably it accreted granitic rock on the top, which is the lightest, and then basalts underneath that, and then even heavier basalts and then other stuff below that, and then down to iron in the core. Now, if that's the case, then you have an outer coating, cooling, of granitic rock. Now, we have a planet on which there's only one quarter of the surface is covered by granitic rock. What happened to the rest of it? Where did it go?
I don't believe that theory necessarily holds that it was a uniform distribution, and there certainly were, and especially in the formation of the early Earth, just to give the standard model, there were certainly catastrophic events.
Just so that we can clear it, so I don't want to feel like I'm in an argument here, but essentially if you have an Earth that's molten, it's going to differentiate generally around the Earth. It's not going to segment. You know what I'm saying? One can say, well, it didn't mean this or it doesn't mean that, but according to the way I was taught in school, you have granitic rock. Now, you have to remember that that granitic rock surface, which is between, 4.5 and, say, 1 billion years old, is quite different than the undersea oceanic rock, which is no older than, say, 165 million years old. I mean, if you go looking for ancient fish fossils, you don't go to the deep ocean. You go to Utah.
Right.
You go to China. You go to Italy, but you do not go into the deep ocean because they're not there. There was no deep ocean 200 million years ago that we know of. In other words, you can't find a square yard of it underneath the deep ocean. You can't find it. Doesn't exist.
Now, and you're saying that's because it wasn't there.
Well, or subduction is so efficient that it got every square yard,
mm-hmm.
which I don't believe. I have difficulty believing that. I cannot believe that the ocean floor completely disappeared. I would say it is more reasonable to say that it was never there. Now, that seems hard because, and of course, Sam Carey had a lot of trouble with that because the physicist and other scientists said, Mr. Carey, if you want to prove this, you have to show how matter can be created, because mm-hmm. that's what you're saying, essentially. And Sam Carey, unfortunately, was a geologist. He did not have the ability to defend his point of view because he was a geologist. He understood the geology, and the geology said the Earth grew. You could take the point of view that, no, subduction works and this works and all this. If you take all of these excuses, you could say, no, it's not that way. But if you just go by the geology, that's what he said. if you start putting these things together, you may not come to the same conclusion I come to, but there is lots of other facts. But these are very, very difficult facts to, for me, at least, to deal with. Shallow seas covered a massive part of the United States, a massive part of Asia, and they're gone. They cannot be gone. You cannot say it. It's just not sayable. Now, if that's the case, and somebody comes along and says, well, you know, this is what I think happened. I think the Earth grew, cracks formed, the continents were spread apart, which of course they are, the water fell into the cracks very slowly over a period of time, you have a new depth, water increased, but still water didn't increase to the extent that it did not drain off the shallow seas, and now all the shallow seas are now in the deep ocean. There's a thundering logic to that that I cannot deny.
Now let's talk about the physics part of this, because obviously that's the big stumbling block, right?
Sure. So Carey lost that portion of his argument to such an extent that he tried to make it up later, and he could not really do it. Because you have to come up with a concept that said matter can be made. And that's very hard to do. And when I heard that and I realized that, I thought, you know, there must be a theory out there that explains that. And that's how I'll start my little adventure. I will try to explain how it's possible for Earth to grow by taking out books that everybody else has and reading them and trying to find theories that may explain this. You know, little things that get left by science in the corner and perhaps not examined quite as hard as they ought to be examined.
So what have you come up with?
Well, there's a guy named Carl David Anderson. You guys probably know about Carl David Anderson. In 1932, he was trying to see cosmic rays. And so what he did was he made this barrel-shaped thing, and he pumped the air out of it, made a vacuum, and he allowed certain noble gases to go into it. And what would happen is as cosmic rays would come out of space, they would make these little gas trails. And what he discovered was that spontaneously in these cosmic rays, or as these cosmic rays were going through, it seemed as though something would strike something and break off this, what looked like a particle, and that particle would zap away and it would find an electron or immediately find an electron and annihilate it. Mm-hmm. And the more he examined it, the more he discovered that that, in fact, was a positron, what's called a positron. Positron is equal to an electron in size and in charge, except that a positron is positive and an electron is negative. Scientists observed this and talked about it and had all these conversations about, you know, everybody went to their meetings and everybody decided that this was antimatter. And antimatter was the opposite of matter. Antimatter would annihilate matter. Of course, it wasn't exactly annihilating matter. It was annihilating electrons, its opposite charge. Mm-hmm. It wasn't annihilating protons or neutrons. It was annihilating electrons. So it's interesting there, you know. So we see something created out of essentially nothing, and we call it antimatter because it seems to annihilate an electron. Oddly enough, doesn't really annihilate an electron. What it does, and this is something we found out recently, is that it goes toward an electron, kind of slows down, very quickly orbits the electron, becomes a thing called, I believe it's called positronium, which is, you know, like a comic book title, and then they both disappear, and they fire off whatever energy they have on them.
Gamma rays, I believe.
A form of gamma radiation.
But has anyone ever seen this positronium or actually
do
experiments?
Well, I don't think you can see something that small, but they evidence
right.
it, you know, the way scientists do.
Well, indirectly, but...
You can look it up. It'll be on the Internet, the positronium.
Okay.
This is how it's made, blah, blah, blah. Now, what's interesting is that the sequence of events that gave us antimatter did not necessarily at that time include another observation that was made several years later, and that was that as that positron was created, an electron was created at the very same time, out of nothing. Now, I may be very kind of naive. To me, that looks like they broke apart something that was zero into a plus one into a minus one. Keep it very simple. Now, again, that may be naive on my part, but you know, the thing is that you can't No, we haven't known how a proton is made, and we don't know how quarks are made, and we don't know how anything else is made, but incredibly enough, we know how electrons and positrons are made by this impacting of stuff that happens all the time, everywhere. To me, I know I'm not Sherlock Holmes, but that's a clue. I'd say, you know, maybe I want to pause for a minute before I call that thing antimatter. Because what you've just done, it seems to me, is you've created a plus particle and a minus particle, and the fact that that plus particle seems to seek out and seems to annihilate a negative particle isn't necessarily true. What if that positive particle joins again with that negative particle and they become what they were before they were split apart? What if they become, call it a prime matter particle?
But what about the release of gamma rays, though? I mean,
the thing about gamma radiation is you pick up the gamma radiation from the photon that strikes it. But what you don't lose is you can't lose and haven't lost that negative and that positive electromagnetic field of both of those particles. You lose the gamma radiation that was added to it by the impact, but you don't lose the negative and positive for whatever reason. You could say, well, they cancel each other out, but you know, I don't really think the universe works like that.
How come? Because that's pretty much the key right there.
That's like saying that matter can be created and be destroyed. I would agree that that's not true. I don't think you can destroy a negative and a positive particle simply because they disappear. I don't know what they look like anyway.
Although at present, that's the current observations that have been made.
It was there to be struck. Okay. Something hit it, it split into two particles.
So what do you conclude from this? What's the bottom line?
Okay, I conclude from this that these two are our two basic particles, and they make the universe. They make all the particles of the universe, and you just have to figure out how they do it.
Well, that seems to explain why I'm gaining more weight as I get older.
I guess so. Because you've got too many of those. Electron.
But what about other experiments that show other particles being produced in the debris? Why aren't they primary particles as well?
You sort of have to take it step by step. I'm not a real scientist, you know. I'm an artist, and I don't look at it the way I look at it. I study all the sciences. I study every aspect of science, but I don't study it technically. I don't do the math and all the rest of it. So I just kind of skim the surface and I pick up the stuff that seems to be out there that everybody knows. But it seems to me that if you have a simple universe, really simple universe, okay, nothing is going to be all that complicated. So the question you have to ask is, do we have the kind of universe in which 5 or 6 or 8 or 12 different things are made by nature or by some initiating event? Or are you going to get one thing that happens and, like evolution, things evolve from that? For example, one of the things scientists want to say nowadays is, if you have hydrogen, you can pretty much make anything. That's a big jump. Well, the question then is, can I make hydrogen out of protons, positrons, and electrons? Because if I can do that, then that builds a universe. Now, of course, I'm just a comic book artist. What do I know? But what if I could do that? Not me. What if the universe does that?
So, Neil, let me ask you a question. So you say you've been doing this for 40 years. Obviously, you've put a lot of time and energy and thought into it. Have you ever attempted to publish any of these ideas in the scientific literature or present them to scientists?
I can't imagine a piece of scientific literature that would accept me as a contributor. I can't.
Why is that?
Because, well, usually you have to have degrees and you have to write scientific papers and you have to. It's not something that you. I'm a comic book artist. I'm doing a book and I'm doing a videotape. You have seen some of the videotape.
Yeah.
On my internet. And some of it's pretty striking. I'm probably going to end up having to do a show on NOVA or Discovery to get these ideas across, but not really in scientific literature. There are people who are behind and are part of this, what they call EE, or Expanding Earth Theory, and they seem to be starting to amass in a group, and I think my videos are sort of spurring them on, making them a little bit more optimistic that they'll get a hearing. But why would anybody want to hear, you know, a scientific community want to hear what a comic book artist says? You know, it just doesn't make any sense to me. I don't think that's the path. On the other hand, I don't know what the path is. I mean, if I'm right, then it's not just a theory about the Earth growing. It's a theory about how everything works. And that's way too big for anybody in the scientific community to even accept or even listen to. I mean, just beyond comprehension. I don't think that they're ready for it. And so there's no path. In other words, whoever in the past has done something new to change science really haven't left a guidebook lying around for me to know how to do it. So I'm sort of making my way blindly through it.
Yeah, Einstein had no scientific reputation, and he pretty much changed all of physics in a pretty radical way.
When I have no reputation, I'm going to change physics. I'm pretty much determined to do it. I mean, I'm not coming to you saying, you know, I mean, sometimes I'll act hopeless and helpless and all the rest of it, but I don't really feel that way. I feel pretty strongly that, you know, I've got an awful lot of science in here, and to be perfectly honest, I've been trying to destroy this theory myself for the last 10 years, and I can't find a hole in it.
Well, since you bring that up, that was one of my questions for you. So what do you think would be a major test of your theory? How could you – what kind of observation or experiment can be done that would distinguish the growing Earth theory from the standard plate tectonic theory, for example?
Well, in all honesty, I don't know. If I say things that are obvious that prove the theory, all I have are things that prove the theory. I don't have hardly anything that disproves the theory. Somebody could go down to the middle of the Earth and prove that it was molten iron. That would prove that I'm wrong. If these French guys that are going to drop a spaceship on the moon to discover something that they kind of are very vague about discovering, but I suspect that they're trying to discover whether or not the moon is hollow. If they find that it's not hollow, then I will probably be wrong, and I would accept that as a defeat. But I don't think that's going to happen. I think they're going to find that it's hollow. They actually have dropped something on the moon about 20 years ago. They discovered that the thing echoed for like 3 hours. If they discovered that dinosaurs were the size of elephants, sauropods were the size of elephants, that would do it, but they're not. They're 4 to 5 times bigger. And, you know, what I've done is I've studied an awful lot of science in an awful lot of different areas. For example, if you were to build a building over 10 stories high and you made it out of brick and wood, it would collapse because it can't support itself unless it has steel. That means you have to make it out of something else that's denser. Well, there's a paleontologist at the Alberta Museum who we were in contact with to ask a very simple question to, that did, was there any indication that dinosaur bones were any more dense than the bones of animals today? The answer was categorically no. They were no more dense than the bones of, say, an elephant or a large animal. Well, if that's the case, you cannot have a sauropod that's 4 to 5 times the size of an elephant. It can't be. It's physically impossible.
But you're saying it's impossible, but have you done the calculations as someone, you know?
There's no calculation for that.
There is. Sure, absolutely.
Well, I mean, okay. And, I'm not, yes, it would have to be 4 to 5 times as dense.
No. You're assuming that the structure of bones is that an elephant is as big as a creature can get with their structure of bones. Perhaps that the standard structure of bones are pretty damn strong, actually, and their structure is very efficient, that it couldn't support the size of a sauropod. And
actually,
there's no evidence for that, though. I mean, so the
you know, I agree with you, and I think that's a really good argument. I think that it's important for people who disagree with me to have these arguments, and they should do that, and that's all great. But if you go on Discovery, I don't know if it's Discovery or Nova, you get these. There's these two scientists that come on, two paleontologists, and one of them says that a Tyrannosaurus rex was a scavenger. Mm-hmm. You might have seen the show.
Yes.
The other one says, no, he was a predator. And the guy who says no, he was a scavenger says, look, he cannot be a scavenger. He runs. He can't run Because if he were to run at 40 or 50 miles an hour, his head would snap off. And I'm an artist, and I study anatomy. I'm actually a pretty good artist, so I study this stuff. Clearly, a Tyrannosaurus rex was a predator, probably ran 60 miles an hour, up to 60 miles an hour. An elephant, it weighs what a Tyrannosaurus rex weighs, but a Tyrannosaurus rex runs like a lion. And I understand the arguments of people. People say, well, an elephant could be, you know, 10% bigger than it is and still survive. Could be maybe 20% bigger. Can't be five times bigger. Makes no sense.
Well,
I'm just common sense, you know?
That seems like such a glaring, an obvious thing. I just can't imagine that would have been missed by all the scientists. How could they possibly, you know, how could, if you can't have a dinosaur that big, how was that missed?
The truth is that they didn't miss it. And in fact, when this whole debate came up when Sam Carey was around, they had that debate. In fact, I remember when I was a kid, I went to the Museum of Natural History, and they even talked about it. People kind of forget, you know, they talked about, you know, how could a dinosaur be so big and the bone density be the same, blah, blah, blah. But it was. So it's sort of like when you go to school, you know, somebody says light doesn't travel through space, it travels through nothing, and you go, how can it travel through nothing?
Right.
It doesn't make any sense, and you start arguing, and they say, yeah, well, you may believe that, but on Friday it's going to be on the test, and if you get it wrong, you're going to fail this course. Well, you know, it's Friday, and Neil has failed the course, I got to tell you. I have totally failed the course, because none of these things make any sense to me. I can't travel through an Earth. I can't put – you've seen some of my videos. You look at the various moons and you see the stuff coming together. I haven't doctored those things. I haven't done anything with them. I've just moved them together. You can take pictures off the internet and slide pictures of Europa together, and they fit together.
Yeah, talking about moons and gravity. So let me just try to see some ramifications here. If the Earth had less mass in the past, therefore it was less massive and had less gravitational pull, correct? If that's the case, why is the Earth's mass is increasing, why is the moon moving away from us instead of coming closer to us as the gravitational pull inevitably increases?
Because the moon is getting bigger too. Well, they're all growing.
Well,
that would make it even worse.
That would make it even worse. That's right.
Not really, no, because it sort of works like this. You have to understand the whole theory. There's a whole massive theory to this.
Gravity is gravity.
Well, gravity is not necessarily gravity, is it? Gravity could be electromagnetic in nature, couldn't it?
No, I don't know of anyone that would agree with that.
I don't think anybody agrees with that. With
okay,
me.
All right, good.
I agree with you, but good. No, the funny thing is that all the planets seem to be lined up a given distance away from the sun, mm-hmm. a mathematical distance, and the distance was measured by a guy named Bode. I didn't actually know about Bode. I actually did it myself, and I came up with a slightly different formula. And you know, the funny thing about the formula that Bode created and I created is that we both discovered that Uranus is out of order. It's slightly in closer to Earth than it ought to be, because they're all mathematically a given distance further out from the sun according to the law that Bode created and the one that I created, which is very, very similar. Now, I'm assuming, probably illogically so, that those planets are riding on electromagnetic lines of the sun. Well, somebody would say, that doesn't make any sense. Then I would say, well, is the sun not the biggest electromagnetic magnet in our solar system? Yes, it is. Do electromagnets have lines, electromagnetic lines? Yes.
Right.
Well, okay, if all magnets have electromagnetic lines, wouldn't the lines of the sun be the biggest damn electromagnetic lines of them all? Yes. Isn't there iron in the planets? Yes. Well, wouldn't they, if they're going to be attracted anywhere, going to be attracted to those lines?
Yeah, but it's too weak when you get out to Uranus and Jupiter. I mean, gravity just swamps it. There's really, my understanding is that the magnetic effect would be negligible.
I understand what you're saying, but you know, that's not how magnets work. Like, if you're attracted to a magnet, you're attracted to a magnet directly to the magnet, but if you work under certain conditions, you can find the lines. So the question is, let's just say you're in orbit, okay? Let's just say whatever's drawing you toward the sun is going to allow you to be in orbit. Is there a favorable orbit to be in? And would that orbit be an electromagnetic line? If that's the case, and the universe isn't exploding, which I guess is the opposite of gravity, because that's the way it seems to be, and why isn't there a big crunch and everything is being pulled together? Well, because it's all blowing away. I don't think so. I think what's happened is electromagnetic energy has created a balance in our universe, and as our universe grows, the electromagnetic fields grow outward.
And the magnetic fields grow.
So you're saying, just to be clear, I just want to be clear on this. You're saying there's no such thing as gravity.
Well, all right, let me put it this way. Here's two things, okay? Neither of which you'll agree with, but you can play with them. If I believe the physics that's presented to me says every action has an equal and opposite reaction, I believe that. I think that is a good standard to go by. I don't know what the opposite action to gravity is, but I know what the opposite action to electromagnetic energy is, negative and positive. I don't know what the opposite of gravity is. I don't think it exists. Now, when we describe the Big Bang Theory, we got explosion. That's the opposite. Okay, you have gravity and you have explosion. I don't believe that. I don't think that's a good explanation.
Wait, but what about the new discovery of, quintessence, Steve? The
accelerating force?
The accelerating expansion of the universe that was recently discovered. I would say that's a good candidate for the opposite of gravity.
I would say that is a good candidate for putting aside the Big Bang Theory.
Oh,
well, it's not incompatible with the Big Bang, though.
It's not compatible with the Big Bang Theory because it wouldn't be accelerating. If anything, it would be going at the same speed or slowing down.
Well,
right?
Clearly, we can't really talk about that definitively because this is still highly speculative. Nobody knows what the answer is. We don't know really why the universe seems to be accelerating in its
well,
expansion.
Well, I think I can tell you.
So are you going to make a specific prediction?
Prediction, yes. I think I can tell you.
Okay.
The universe is growing. It's really not illogical because it seems to me, well, let me put it this way. You sort of believe one of two things. You believe that the universe and all the matter in the universe always existed, always will exist, world without end, amen, same amount, no more or no less. Or you believe that at some point there was no matter and then some was created, and then some more, and then some more, and then some more until we have the universe that we have today. Now, if you believe the first, good luck. If you believe the second, then who turned off the off switch?
Neil, would you also say that the sun or, you know, that stars are growing in mass as well?
Well, we are told by scientists, surprised me along the way, that our sun grew, one in size and two in brightness. Now, that's the only one that I've had admitted since I was a kid, but I say that not only did the sun grow, but Jupiter grew, and that's why it's so massive that all those meteorites that used to hit the moon, Earth, and Mars are now hitting Jupiter because it seems to be a meteor magnet. Some scientists even agree with that. Now, if it is now a meteor magnet, why wasn't it a billion years ago?
Well, who says it wasn't?
Well, we say it wasn't because we have way bigger craters and way bigger impacts on Mars and the Moon than we have currently.
Of course, the solar system was filled with debris during the formation. It's inevitable that we were hit.
Hold on a second. See, I learned that in school, too. Let me see. That theory started 150 years ago where people got together and they said, well, this is how you got a solar system. You have this area of space, and it's filled up with all these meteorites. Okay, well, that's not the Big Bang because that's mostly hydrogen. So they can't. Where'd they come from? They came from exploding planets.
well, I don't think anyone realistically.
Wait a second.
That.
To be fair,
it comes from New York. Says that. Well, just want you to know. Museum of Natural History in New York says that meteorites come from exploding planets. Where do you get all that stuff?
Well, it was made inside stars.
Big Bang.
It was made, made inside of stars. I mean, that's not a mystery.
Okay. Why is the inside of stars throwing out meteorites? I mean,
because
that
they,
doesn't make any sense.
The standard explanation is that as stars go through their life cycle, and by the way, they can grow and change in brightness. That has to do with their the rate at which they're burning their hydrogen and versus their own
gravity.
But once
well, wait a second. We're talking about stars.
Yeah.
Okay. In a universe that's 15 billion years old,
right.
And Earth is 4.5 billion years old. So we're back in a place where we're closer to the, quote, Big Bang, if anybody wants to believe that.
Yeah.
And we're saying it's a more primitive universe, okay, close to the hydrogen. We've definitely got hydrogen in stars, an awful lot of hydrogen. In fact, 80% of our star presumably is hydrogen, 20% or a little bit less is helium,
right. Mm-hmm.
And then a very small amount is hard stuff. Where... That's part of what got assembled. Where did all this stuff come from?
From older stars, from second-generation stars.
But older stars, when were they made? You're breaking the universe into thirds here.
Well,
okay.
But not
you're
all,
saying
not
stars,
all stars
were made
stars
the first
last...
third, the second third. I don't understand.
Some stars only last for a few hundred million years.
When a star explodes,
right.
Let's say it's a supernova,
yeah.
Okay?
Okay.
I kind of assume it's going to turn into hydrogen.
That's not true.
Or it's not going to be
all
chunks.
No,
all the heavy elements are created in supernova explosions.
But
right?
Aren't those pieces blown out at near light speed straight out of the universe? Why are they floating in this galaxy?
Not the universe. They would expand and it could cause a planetary
nebula.
They would slow down. They could impact other hydrogen clouds and create other solar systems.
Hold on. They slowed down. The universe isn't slowing down. It's going out faster.
Yeah, but that's the universe. If you
right, the local area, the local
right,
yeah, local, yeah,
local phenomena, not
local phenomena. How did this local phenomenon attract all this stuff in the beginning?
I mean, how was the universe not uniform to begin with? That is a legitimate question of cosmology,
well,
is why, where did the original non-uniformity
no
of the universe
point.
Come from?
There's not only not a center point, there's no way to explain the collection of this stuff. It's ridiculous. You've got an area of space that gravity is sitting in the background waiting for there to be enough stuff to be collected in an area for gravity to step forward and say, now I'm going to build a solar system, then instantly, practically, build a solar system out of this stuff. That idea was created 150 years ago by people who knew nothing about science, who tried to explain the universe, and we've been trying to put patches in it for 150 years. It's ridiculous. If you're looking for meteorites, remember we talked about this idea of there's giant meteorites and they all collected into planets. There are some meteorites in our solar system that are 4.5 billion years old. No iron meteorites, no silicate meteorites, but no normal kind of meteorites that you think of. They're called what are called chondrites, and they're made out of chondrules, which are little particles that the size of a pencil tip, and they gather by accretion. They collect by creating a little gravity. And so all these little chondrites gather into this meteorite, and material that makes chondrites, like dust, okay, collects into this meteorite and makes a chondrite meteorite. This chondrite meteorite cannot be made in a planet or in a sun. It has to be assembled in space. A chondrite meteorite is the only meteorite that we can collect and we can see and we have falling to the Earth that is as old as 4.5 billion years old. All other meteorites are younger than that. Now, and when I say this, I'm saying this because I couldn't have this theory without studying everything. And one of the problems with science, and you guys may know something about this, is specialization. People find so much about a particular thing, but they don't know about all the rest of it. And it's one of the things that made Sam Carey fail when he presented his theory. He failed because he wasn't a physicist. The bad thing about that is once you discover how the Earth grew, and you understand it all, to understand how the universe works. And it doesn't work anything the way, like the way we think it does. It doesn't mean that the rules that we know aren't there. They are there. But it adds an overview of the whole thing that puts it into a matrix that makes it make sense. And it makes it make sense from every possible point of view. It has to explain everything.
Neil, we're actually running out of time. It was a very fascinating interview. We're obviously going to have to...
I hope you guys enjoyed yourself. And
we're going to have to agree to disagree at the end. I obviously don't have the same view of science that you do.
Sure you do. You have
well, it sounds like, just to conclude, that you're basically saying that the process of science, the community of science, is broken because they're hyper-specialized and they don't talk with each other. And
there was
they can't get a view
like,
of the of
yeah.
the big picture. I it's disagree. I think there's a lot of consilience in science. If somebody comes up with a theory in one field that has major implications for another field, then they talk with scientists in that other field.
But you would think that way, wouldn't you?
Well, I'm actually a practicing scientist, so I have a little bit of an idea of how it works.
But what I'm saying is that you would think that way, and you would make that statement, right?
Yeah.
That makes sense.
I do think this way.
But right,
not assuming it. That's my
that's
my conclusion after being, you know, not only being a very interested layperson,
but
also...
But it's your conclusion not having considered the alternate, is what I'm saying.
All right. Well, Neil, we appreciate it.
Thank you, Neil.
Again,
thanks, Neil.
Next time, guys.
Thanks for joining us.
I hope this was interesting.
Very interesting.
It definitely was interesting.
Very much so.
Take care.
Good night. Good night, Neil.
Good night, guys.
So that was Neil Adams, a very, very interesting interview. The problem, I think, you know, with Neil is that he didn't really let us get a word in edgewise. I mean, we had a hard time giving the counter-arguments to what he was saying, so I do feel obligated to go back and talk about some of the things that he brought up. First of all, you know, the idea that electrons and positrons, or anti-electrons, can lead to the creation of matter is simply false. And he actually said it himself. It's like you start with zero and you create plus one and minus one. That's right. And when you add one to minus one, you get zero again. You actually are making nothing. So he makes this leap from making, you know, nothing, basically a net zero matter, and said, but what if they come together and they form something? That's a big what if. And that's kind of the basis of everything that flows from there.
Neil's interview was a little bit like the Gish Gallop, wasn't it?
It was. Referring to Dwayne Gish, who you talked to him about, he's a creationist who would just throw so many things at you that you couldn't, you couldn't deal with them all. I do think, you know, again, it was interesting to see how he spent 40 years. He's obviously an intelligent guy working on this problem, and listening to, I think most of our listeners will notice that there's just so many things seem wrong about what he's saying, even if you're not sure exactly what it is. I think it's fascinating from my point of view of how someone's thinking can go so wrong. So the sort of the logic is more important to me, you know, than anything else. And I think so. A few of the mistakes that he's making. First of all, I think it's a big problem if you are so ready to dismiss the entire scientific community. I mean, I think, you know, there's a little bit of hubris involved in that. If you really take what he's saying, he's basically saying that the entire physics community is wrong about elementary particles and the nature of elementary particles and matter and antimatter, and also gravity. They're also completely wrong, and electromagnetism. They're basically wrong about everything.
Gravity, schmavity.
Geologists are wrong about plate tectonics, and cosmologists are wrong about the nature and origin and evolution of the universe and stars and planetary systems. And, you know, biologists are wrong about dinosaurs and their physiology and the ability of their structures to function.
True, and not only that, that stuff is true, but it's also very specific things. I tried to get in a little more information about the whole magnetism and gravity thing. I mean, one thing about the magnetism was that, you know, basically it's pretty much accepted and verifiable and justified in literally tens of thousands of experiments of how the strength of a magnetic field drops off. You get twice as far away, it's eight times as weak. I mean, that's just the way it is. There's really no question about that.
Right.
And he's saying that it's affecting the outer planets.
Right, which is just impossible.
It's really, you know, just really not true. I mean, there's not much more to say.
It kind of reminded me of a conspiracy theorist in that You know, he makes this one huge assumption, huge leap about the Earth growing. And that leads to, that creates three or four really significant scientific problems. So he makes
domino effect.
Yeah, it's a domino effect. So he says, okay, well, all right, so the biologists are completely wrong about everything too. You know, I'll throw that in as well. And that creates further problems. And then before you know it, all of science is completely wrong. Basically, everything that you know is wrong, which, you know, we've heard before too, right? And a legitimate scientist, if they came up with a theory and it was contradicted by an entire discipline of science, they would say, okay, well, there's got to be something wrong with my theory.
Or I had better have a stack of experiments.
Right, right.
You know, positively proving what I'm trying to say here. To the best of what I heard, Neil had...
No, I did manage to ask him directly, yeah, how would you test it? And he couldn't come up with any way that he...
I think what we witnessed tonight was someone who's a fan of science, and he's very intrigued about these conclusions that he's drawing. But I also got the impression that he does know deep down that his conclusions aren't things to be 100% believed.
Oh, first of all, I have to disagree. A fan of science, I believe. Yeah, I believe he was disdainful of science.
Let me clarify then.
Okay.
Because I agree with where you're going with that, Perry, but he did say that he's always been interested since he was very young in science and in technology. I mean, he mentioned that, and I happen to know that from reading about him, that he is a fan of just science. Mm-hmm. You know, I think
he's not the institutions of science, but of science itself.
Yeah, of the product of science might be more accurate. But I definitely think that he, needs to just take a really, really hard look at what he's saying and talk to. You know, why doesn't he just talk to some high-end physicist? Why doesn't
Jay,
he go
you don't,
talk
you
to
don't
sound
think,
like he wants to?
You don't think the guy believes in his theories?
I think I sense the germ of disbelief in what some of the way he came off saying some of his theories in the way that...
He was very evasive, though. I mean, he would basically go off on some non sequitur whenever he tried to...
It was simply a tactic. Yeah. It was a tactic to try and be somewhat self-deprecating. That's simply something you learn as you get older, as you get more mature, that self-deprecation is... But it's just a tactic. He believes...
Harry, how come you don't use any of that?
He said mature.
Listen closer. He believes everything he espouses.
Yeah, I mean, you know, it's basically the armchair musings of somebody who's interested in science but doesn't really understand the current state of scientific findings or methodology. But again, it's just it's striking, you know, how he was willing to accept how profoundly wrong thousands of brilliant people can be, and you know, he just said, "Hey, what if it's this way? Oh, that may be right." You know, just these casual musings.
The one thing I wanted to hear him say, you know what, I am formally putting together a submission to the appropriate journals. I'm in contact with scientists that are helping me put these documents together correctly. And he really was just dismissive of the idea that they wouldn't be accepting of
any of
his submissions.
Well, listen, I've written in the past, as other people have, you know, the sort of red flags or the characteristics that are typical of pseudoscientists. And he really displayed every single one during the interview. And that's one, Jay, where they basically make an end run around the standard institutions of peer review and of science, the ways in which we test our ideas and have some kind of sense that they have value. He wants to just write a book, you know, go right to the public and...
He wants to go on TV, Steve.
Yeah.
He said specifically Discovery and, you know, because, frankly, because they're not peer reviewed.
It's an end run around the institutions of science. Well, we're pretty low on time, so let's go on to science or fiction.
It's time for Science or Fiction.
So every week I come up with three science news items or facts. Two are genuine, one is fictitious. And I challenge my esteemed panel of skeptics to sniff out which one is fake. And if
they couldn't make it, so we're here instead.
Very good, Bob. Very good.
So, no theme for this week.
Good. Hodgepodge.
Item number one. A recently published study indicates that educational toys are more effective than preschool in promoting later academic achievement in young children. Number two, scientists have discovered that some woolly mammoths were actually blonde. And number three, paleontologists down under have recently discovered fossil evidence of a carnivorous, long-fanged kangaroo. So we got educational toys are actually helpful, more helpful than preschool. Blonde mammoths or long-fanged carnivorous kangaroos. All right.
I'll go first. So the blonde mammoths, are these California mammoths or wandering about?
They love the beaches. You
know, all right. A mammoth that has different colored hair. Okay, I can take that, you know. Educational toys are actually better than preschool, was it?
Right.
For long-term development? Not much goes on in preschool, from what I can see. Yeah. That seems pretty reasonable. The carnivorous kangaroos are too cool, though. I mean, I don't want to say that's fake. Because, you know, carnivorous kangaroos, that's so cool. Could, like, hop around and jump on your head and bite you. I'll say, unfortunately, the long-toothed Joey is fake.
Okay, Jay.
I tend to agree with Perry. You know, the thing is, there's a social element, though, when they're in school. It's not just what they learn. It's, you know, okay, they're teaching them colors or whatever they would do, but it's also the children interacting with each other. So I would say no on that one, definitely. You know, and like Perry said, too, blonde woolly mammoths, sure. You know, who the hell, why not? So I'll go with the kangaroo. I don't think that kangaroos have an evil bone in their body.
Wait, Jay, I thought you said number one was didn't sound right.
Yeah.
Yeah, I'm going to disagree with number one. That's what.
You say number one's fiction.
Yes, but I don't like the idea of kangaroos being that evil either. So.
But you're saying number one is fiction. Okay, Evan.
My gut tells me number two is fiction, but I have a feeling that's a distraction, a curveball, if you will. So I'm going to say number one is fiction. That educational toys more effective than preschool.
Okay, Bob.
I'm going to say congratulations to Evan and Jay. You are correct. Number one is fiction.
Okay, so everyone agrees that the blonde woolly mammoth is science. Now let me ask you a question: were any of you bothered by how the scientists could have known that the mammoths were blonde?
Don't they find them all the time?
Haven't they found frozen chunks of hair and stuff?
Yeah.
How do we know that?
They were blonde ones.
Well, how do I know? What do I keep up with the mammoth literature?
Yeah, didn't you get your mammoth monthly, Perry?
All right, Steve, drop the bomb.
They didn't find blonde hair until recently. That's the whole point, I thought.
Actually, it was not from a discovery of a blonde hair.
How'd they determine it?
They determined it because by looking at the genes, they actually have been able. They've been starting to sequence the genes of the woolly mammoth.
Oh, that's very cool. Interesting.
Wow.
Yeah,
that's great.
They've been able to tell that, you know, but mammals share genes for coloring, and the genes that would make a mammal's hair blonde are the ones that some, you know, woolly mammoths have. Actually, some of them were described as ginger in color.
Oh no.
This was so. This is a genetic study. So there probably were two populations. It's one dark brown, which is the typical picture that we're used to, and one like a blonde ginger kind of variety of woolly mammoth. They have a picture on the article here. It looks pretty cool. Now, Perry, you were the only one who did not believe in the carnivorous long-faced kangaroo.
I know.
And that one is science also. That one is true. Oh,
that's cool.
It is cool.
I'm glad I was wrong.
In fact, in this region, the paleontologists have been pulling tons of fossils out of the ground. They found some demon duck and lots of varieties of kangaroos,
nice.
Including a quadrupedal kangaroo that ran, did not hop. And one of these species was clearly carnivorous, had these long carnivorous fangs. Very neat.
Cool.
Excellent.
I like that.
So that means that number one, that educational toys are more effective than preschool promoting academic achievement, is fiction.
Yeah, I think Jay nailed that one. The social aspect is key.
Well, actually, this is based upon a study that showed something completely different. Okay, so this is a study that was published recently by Eric Knudsen of the Stanford University School of Medicine in Stanford, California. And he looked at, you know, evidence for the effects of different things, toys, school, diet, whatever. And he found that the single most important factor in determining academic achievement in children is what? What do you guys think? parents playing with them. Quality time with the Rents.
Good.
That's it.
Holy shit.
So they basically say that, you know, the children, you know, desperately need attention from their parents, and when parents play with their children, the belief is that they actually stimulates them to form new neurons, and their brain grows, and that gives them raw resources that will go on later to be vital in developing themselves intellectually. So all of the yuppie parents who are spending money on all of these fancy toys and...
But doesn't that contradict... I mean, if you're buying fancy toys for your kid, doesn't that mean you're playing with them? If you stick them in preschool, it means you're absent.
No, because a lot of those toys are like the Mozart video where the kid's stuck in front of a TV watching a video about Mozart. Or they're not necessarily... And if you do play with your kids, it doesn't matter what the toy is or if you have a toy. It's just you playing with your child is the most important thing. Final segment this week is just the answer to last week's skeptical puzzle, and I do have a new quick puzzle for next week. First, going back 2 weeks, the answer to the Monty Hall problem has actually generated more email than any other topic we've ever discussed.
Enough already. No more emails about Monty Hall.
We've been getting quite a few.
I'm not surprised,
not
though.
Not surprised.
I love this problem.
It generates a lot of interest, which is why we used it. Most of the emails and most of the messages on the forums actually got it right. A lot of people wrote in just to give their explanation for the correct answer. But, you know, a lot of emails came in disagreeing with us and making incorrect arguments of why the statistics are different, why they're 50-50, et cetera. And again, it's interesting that how counterintuitive this problem is, which is the whole point of it, you know. But let me give you the answer to last week's puzzle. Briefly, the puzzle was to name a medical pseudoscience that, although now thoroughly disproved and rejected by mainstream science, at its inception was on the correct side of a major scientific debate of the time. About a half a dozen or so people wrote in to give their guess at the answer, and all of them gave the same answer, phrenology, which is correct. That does fulfill all the criteria of the puzzle. Two people pointed out the fact that I had given the same puzzle in a science or fiction on episode number 12 about a year ago, which is true. I did recycle this bit of information. But part of it was, so first of all, it was given it the other way around, so it was asking it from the other direction. But also, I wanted to see if anyone would come up with any other answers that also fit the criteria. Only one person gave an alternate guess, and that was eugenics, which I don't agree with. Eugenics was just really a distortion of natural selection. It really wasn't on the correct side of any specific debate.
Eugenics was political.
Yeah, it was.
It was fascism. It was political.
Now I do have another answer. The other reason why I did this, because I do have another answer in mind. It's not as clean as the phrenology answer, but tell me if you buy this. When homeopathy first came out, Hahnemann, who was promoting homeopathy. None of the principles of homeopathy turned out to be true, but his point was that the medicines of the time were more toxic than they were helpful. And at the time, mainstream medicine was experimenting with mineral-based pharmaceuticals, you know, basically using minerals as drugs, and they were all horribly toxic. So in a way, Hahnemann was correct in that the mineral approach to pharmacotherapy was probably a blind alley, and most of those things were toxic and did not have any useful pharmacological effect, and that his alternative, which was basically water, was actually safer and better than what was the standard treatment of the time. None of his other claims, again, turned out to be correct. So that I think you could fit that answer into the puzzle as well. I do have a new puzzle for next week. This one is a sort of play on words, so bear with me. This is a very, very simple question. When is a boomerang a type of dinnerware? Give you the hint is that it's kind of a play on words. And, of course, all these have a somewhat skeptical angle to them. That's it for this week. Guys, thanks for joining me.
Oh, you're welcome, Steve.
Thank
you're
you, welcome. Doctor.
Always
Good
a pleasure.
Show.
So until next week, this is your Skeptic's Guide to the Universe. The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe is produced by the New England Skeptical Society. For information on this and other podcasts, please visit our website at www.theskepticsguide.org. Please send us your questions, suggestions, and other feedback. You can use the Contact Us page on our website, or you can send us an email to info@theskepticsguide.org. Theorem is produced by Kinetto and is used with permission.
Sleepless nights, slow burn days, problems, proofs, endless delays.